what hour your clock strikes. Here, it's always Halloween. And I'm always your haunted host, Luce Tomlin Brenner. This week, it's actually Halloween. And we're going to do something a little different this week. You know, I spend all year gathering my goods, my gourds, my black cats, my horror movies, my candy. And now that it's here, I'm just kind of ready to be scared. And I hope you are too, listener, because today we're going to pivot and we're going to dive into the history of one of my all-time favorite short, scary stories. Last year, Guillermo del Toro brought a whole new generation into the fold of scary stories to tell in the dark. This was my favorite series of scary books when I was a kid. I used to go to my school's library to not check them out because I was much too scared to bring them into my home, but I would read them during our library hour at school. I would tuck myself away in a corner and flip through the nightmarish illustrations by Stephen Gammell, and I would get myself all worked up, and then we'd all have to be ushered off to gym, and I'd be shaking and much too upset to kick a kickball around. Alvin Schwartz chilled an entire generation of millennials with his trilogy, Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark. But one of his books outside that series does not get nearly as much play, even though it practically ruined my life as a child. I grew up with teacher parents who would occasionally bring home books that interested me. One of these books was In a Dark, Dark Room and Other Scary Stories. At this age, I wasn't paying attention to authors, so I did not realize that Alvin Schwartz had written both the books that I did not allow in my house and this book that my dad had brought home. The cover was disarming, to say the least. The illustrated monsters on the front are certainly spooky, but above the title, In a Dark, Dark Room, is a cheerful white banner proclaiming, "I can read, level 2, which insinuates that this book is appropriate for very small children, and I am here to say now as an adult, it is not. Published in 1984, this is a collection of short stories and poems that are retold by Alvin Schwartz, based on folktale and legends that have been passed down for hundreds of years. Within this collection, there is the story The Teeth, In the Graveyard, In a Dark, Dark Room, The Night It Rained, The Pirate, and The Ghost of John. When I was reading this as a child, I got through most of these stories, and I did feel as though they were beneath me, silly and not very memorable. I whizzed through the pages, bold, like a grown-up or a teenager might. I might even be ready to watch Nightmare on Elm Street at this pace, I thought. But then I got to a story that absolutely destroyed me. It's called The Green Ribbon. If your life hasn't been ruined by The Green Ribbon, don't fret, because I'm going to read it to you now. Once there was a girl named Jenny. She was like all the other girls, except for one thing. She always wore a green ribbon around her neck. There was a boy named Alfred in her class. Alfred liked Jenny, and Jenny liked Alfred. One day he asked her, "Why do you wear that ribbon all the time?" "I cannot tell you," said Jenny. But Alfred kept asking, "But why do you wear it?" And Jenny would say, "It's not important." Jenny and Alfred grew up and fell in love. One day they got married. After their wedding, Alfred said, Now that we are married, you must tell me about the green ribbon.
You still must wait, said Jenny. I'll tell you when the time is right.
Years passed. Alfred and Jenny grew old. One day, Jenny became very sick. The doctor told her she was dying. Jenny called Alfred to her side. Alfred, she said, now I can tell you about the green ribbon. Untie it, and you will see why I could not tell you before. Slowly and carefully, Alfred untied the ribbon, and Jenny's head fell off. One of the terrifying aspects of this story is how short it is. The amount of time that goes between getting married and losing one's head, it's a matter of 2 pages. And the fact that a ribbon could possibly hold your head to your neck, it's shocking and very hard to wrap your head around as an 8 or 9-year-old. I did not wear chokers for years after I read this story because of the creeping thought that perhaps the choker itself had some sort of a power to sever through your neck. Now, because this is such a short story, it doesn't seem like there's a lot of background in there other than the fact that some people hold secrets and they might be terrifying. However, this 1984 story actually seems to be based on a story from 1970 by the writer Anne McGovern that has a lot more interesting symbolism in it. Let's listen to this version. It's called The Velvet Ribbon. Once there was a man who fell in love with a beautiful girl, and before the next full moon rose in the sky, they were wed. To please her husband, the young wife wore a different gown each night. Sometimes she was dressed in yellow. Other nights she wore red or blue or white. And she always wore a black velvet ribbon around her slender neck. Day and night she wore that ribbon, and it was not long before her husband's curiosity got the better of him. "Why do you always wear that ribbon?" he asked. She smiled a strange smile and said not a word. At last her husband got angry, and one night he shouted at his bride, "Take that ribbon off. I'm tired of looking at it."
"You'll be sorry if I do," she replied, "so I won't."
Every morning at breakfast, the husband ordered his wife to remove the black velvet ribbon from around her neck. Every night at dinner, he told her the same thing. But every morning at breakfast and every night at dinner, all his wife would say in return was, "You'll be sorry if I do, so I won't." A week had passed. The husband could no longer look into his wife's eyes. He could only stare at that black velvet ribbon around her neck. One night, as his wife lay sleeping, he tiptoed to her sewing basket. He took out a pair of scissors. Quickly and quietly, careful not to awaken her, he bent over his wife's bed, and snip went the scissors, and the velvet ribbon fell to the floor, and snap came off her head. It rolled over to the floor in the moonlight, wailing tearfully. "I told you you'd be sorry." This version of the story is about 100 times more disturbing. It's really got everything creepy. A man trying to assert himself angrily over a woman's body. A horrific murder that is steeped in a baffling scientific anomaly, and a decapitated head wailing in the moonlight. Lira Radford writes on Ranker about some of the interesting symbolism within these stories and how the ribbons symbolize different things throughout history.
In the 18th century, after the French Revolution, women wore red chokers in remembrance of those who lost their heads to the guillotine. In the 19th century, women who wore black chokers were thought to be involved in sex work. In these stories, the ribbon represents a secret that the husband just can't bear to not know. In the version from 1970, the man is so overcome with the fact that his wife has a past that he can't know about that despite her telling him that she doesn't want to share it with him, he takes matters into his own hands, essentially killing her because he couldn't deal with the fact that she had an unknowable past. While the origin of this folklore is unknown, it is thought to have originated during the time of the French Revolution. However, there's one more version of this story you probably have not heard, and it was told by an author I bet you love, Washington Irving, the father of the American short story, known for Legend of Sleepy Hollow and Rip Van Winkle. This story is from 1824, and it's called The Adventure of the German Student. On a stormy night in the tempestuous times of the French Revolution, a young German was returning to his lodgings at a late hour across the old part of Paris. The lightning gleamed and the loud claps of thunder rattled through the lofty, narrow streets. But I should tell you first something about this young German. Gottfried Wolfgang was a young man of a good family. He had studied for some time at Göttingen, but being a visionary and an enthusiastic character, he had wandered into those wild and speculative doctrines which have so often bewildered German students. His secluded life, his intense application, and the singular nature of his studies had an effect on both his mind and his body. His health was impaired, his imagination diseased. He had been indulging in fanciful speculations on spiritual essences until, like Swedenborg, he had an ideal world of his own all around him. He took up a notion, I do not know from what cause, that there was an evil influence hanging over him, an evil genius or spirit seeking to ensnare him and ensure his perdition. Such an idea working on his melancholy temperament produced the most gloomy effects. He became haggard and despondent. His friends discovered the mental malady preying upon him and determined that the best cure was a change of scene. He was sent, therefore, to finish his studies amidst the splendors and gaieties of Paris. Wolfgang arrived at Paris at the breaking out of the Revolution. The popular delirium at first caught his enthusiastic mind, and he was captivated by the political and philosophical theories of the day. But the scenes of blood which followed shocked his sensitive nature and disgusted him with society and the world, and it made him even more of a recluse. He shut himself up in a solitary apartment. There, in a gloomy street not far from the monastic walls of the Sorbonne, he pursued his favorite speculations. Sometimes he spent hours together in the great libraries of Paris, those catacombs of departed authors rummaging among the hordes of dusty and obsolete works in quest of food for his unhealthy appetite. He was, in a manner, a literary ghoul, feeding in the charnel house of decayed literature. Wolfgang, through solitary and recluse, was of an ardent temperament, but for a time it operated merely upon his imagination. He was too shy and ignorant of the world to make any advances to the fair, but he was a passionate admirer of female beauty, and in his lonely chamber would often lose himself in reveries on form and faces which he had seen. and his fancy would deck out images of loveliness far surpassing the reality. While his mind was in this excited and sublimated state, a dream produced an extraordinary effect on him. It was of a female face of transcendent beauty. So strong was the impression made that he dreamt of it again and again. It haunted his thoughts by day and his slumbers by night. In fine, he became passionately enamored of this shadow of a dream. This lasted so long that it became one of those fixed ideas which haunt the minds of melancholy men and are at times mistaken for madness. Such was Gottfried Wolfgang, and such was his situation at the time I mentioned. He was returning home late one stormy night through some of the old and gloomy streets of the ancient part of Paris. The loud claps of thunder rattled among the high houses of the narrow streets. He came to the square where public executions were performed. The lightning quivered about the pinnacles of the ancient Hotel de Ville and shed flickering gleams over the open space in front. As Wolfgang was crossing the square, he shrank back with horror at finding himself close by the guillotine. It was the height of the Reign of Terror when this dreadful instrument of death stood ever ready, and its scaffold was continually running with the blood of the virtuous and the brave. It had that very day been actively employed in the work of carnage, and there it stood in grim array amidst a silent and sleeping city waiting for fresh victims. Wolfgang's heart sickened within him, and he was turning shuddering from the horrific engine when he beheld a shadowy form cowering, as it were, at the front of the steps which led up to the scaffold. A succession of vivid flashes of lightning revealed it more distinctly. It was a female figure dressed in black. She was seated on one of the lower steps of the scaffold, leaning forward, her face hid in her lap, and her long, disheveled tresses hanging to the ground, streaming with the rain which fell in torrents. Wolfgang paused. There was something awful in this solitary moment of woe. The female had the appearance of being above the common order. He knew the times to be full of vicissitude, and that many a fair head which had once been pillowed on down now wandered houseless. Perhaps this was some poor mourner whom the dreadful axe had rendered desolate, and who sat here heartbroken on the strand of existence from which all that was dear to her had been launched into eternity. He approached and addressed her in the accents of sympathy. She raised her head and gazed wildly at him. What was his astonishment at beholding, by the bright glare of the lightning, the very face which had haunted him in his dreams. It was pale, but ravishingly beautiful. Trembling with violent and conflicting emotions, Wolfgang again accosted her. He spoke something of her being exposed at such an hour of the night and to the fury of such a storm, and he offered to conduct her to her friends. She pointed to the guillotine with a gesture of dreadful signification. "I have no friend on earth," said she. "But you have a home," said Wolfgang. "Yes, in the grave." The heart of the student melted at the words. "If a stranger dare make an offer," said he, "without danger of being misunderstood, I would offer my humble dwelling as a shelter, myself as a devoted friend. I am friendless myself in Paris, a stranger in the land. But if my life could be of some service, it is at your disposal, and should be sacrificed before harm or indignity should come to you." There was an honest earnestness in the young man's manner that had its effect. His foreign accent, too, was in his favor. It showed him not to be a hackneyed inhabitant of Paris. Indeed, there is an eloquence in true enthusiasm that is not to be doubted. The homeless stranger confided herself implicitly to the protection of the student.
He supported her faltering steps across to the Pont Neuf and by the place where the statue of Henry IV had been overthrown by the populace. The storm had abated and the thunder rumbled at a distance. All of Paris was quiet. That great volcano of human passion slumbered for a while to gather fresh strength for the next day's eruption. The student conducted his charge through the ancient streets and by the dusky walls of the Sorbonne to the great dingy hotel which he inhabited. The old portress who admitted them stared with surprise at the unusual sight of the melancholy Wolfgang with a female companion. On entering his apartment, the student, for the first time, blushed at the scantiness and indifference of his dwelling. He had but one chamber, an old-fashioned saloon, heavily carved and fantastically furnished with the remains of former magnificence, for it was one of those hotels in the quarter of the Luxembourg Palace which had once belonged to nobility. It lumbered with books and papers and all the usual apparatus of a student, and his bed stood in recess at one end. When lights were brought and Wolfgang had a better opportunity of contemplating the stranger, he was more than ever intoxicated by her beauty. Her face was pale, but of a dazzling fairness, set off by a profusion of raven hair that hung clustering about it. Her eyes were large and brilliant, with a singular expression approaching almost wildness. As far as her black dress permitted her shape to be seen, it was of perfect symmetry. Her whole appearance was highly striking, though she was dressed in the simplest style. The only thing approaching an ornament which she wore was a broad black band around her neck, clasped by diamonds. The perplexity now commenced with the student how to dispose of the helpless being thus thrown upon his protection. He thought of abandoning his chamber to her and seeking shelter for himself elsewhere. Still, he was so fascinated by her charms, there seemed to be such a spell upon his thoughts and his senses that he could not tear himself from her presence. Her manner, too, was singular and unaccountable. She spoke no more of the guillotine. Her grief had abated. The attentions of the student had first won her confidence and then apparently her heart. She was evidently an enthusiast like himself, and enthusiasts soon understand each other. In the infatuation of the moment, Wolfgang avowed his passion for her. He told her the story of his mysterious dream and how she had possessed his heart before he had even seen her. She was strangely affected by his recital and acknowledged to have felt an impulse towards him equally unaccountable. It was the time for wild theory and wild actions. Old prejudices and superstitions were done away. Everything was under the sway of the goddess of reason. Among other rubbish of the old times, the forms and ceremonies of marriage began to be considered superfluous bonds for honorable minds. Social compacts were the vogue. Wolfgang was too much of a theorist to not be tainted by the liberal doctrines of the day. "Why should we separate?" said he. "Our hearts are united. In the eye of reason and honor, we are as one. What need is there of sordid forms to bind high souls together?" The stranger listened with emotion. She had evidently received illumination at the same school. "You have no home nor family," continued he. "Let me be everything to you, or rather, let us be everything to one another. If form is necessary, form shall be observed. There is my hand. I pledge myself to you forever." "Forever?" the stranger said solemnly. "Forever," repeated Wolfgang. The stranger clasped his hand and extended her own. "Then I am yours," murmured she, and sank upon his bosom. The next morning, the student left his bride sleeping and sallied forth at an early hour to seek more spacious apartments suitable to the change of his situation. When he returned, he found the stranger lying with her head hanging over the bed, one arm thrown over. He spoke to her, but received no reply. He advanced to awaken her from her uneasy posture,
On taking her hand, it was cold. There was no pulsation. Her face was pallid and ghastly. In a word, she was a corpse. Horrified and frantic, he alarmed the house. A sense of confusion ensued. The police were summoned. As the officer of the police entered the room, he started back upon beholding the corpse. "Great heaven!" cried he. "How did this woman come here?" "Do you know anything about her?" said Wolfgang eagerly. "Do I?" exclaimed the police officer. "She was guillotined yesterday." He stepped forward, undid the black collar around her neck, and her head rolled onto the floor. The student burst into a frenzy. The fiend has gained possession of me," shrieked he. "I am lost forever." They tried to soothe him, but it was in vain. He was possessed with the frightful belief that an evil spirit had reanimated the dead body to ensnare him. He went distracted and died in a madhouse. Here, the old gentleman with the haunted head finished his narrative. "And is this really a fact?" said the inquisitive gentleman. "A fact not to be doubted," replied the other. "I had it from the best authority. The student told it to me himself. I saw him at a madhouse in Paris." I hope you enjoyed exploring the history, symbolism, and various version of the ribbon stories. Perhaps I have chilled your bones just in time for Halloween. I would love to hear about any of your favorite scary stories from your youth or otherwise. Perhaps you are also a fan of the retellings of Alvin Schwartz. I think it's fascinating to discover that some of our favorite scary stories from our youth have actually been around for 200 and 300 years, being told and retold again in different ways, depending on what type of social situation we're dealing with at that moment in time. So if you have a story that you'd like to share with our listeners or with me, please call into the All Hallows Hotline at 802-532-DEAD and leave me a message. Or you can write me an e-mail at itsalwayshalloweenpodcast@gmail.com. I'd love to feature your stories and memories on an upcoming Small Frights Friday episode. Now, just to remind you, although the calendar says Halloween is this Saturday, in reality, we know it's always Halloween in our hearts. And it's always Halloween when you're here with me. So come back next week as we continue our dark exploration of Halloween history. If you enjoyed these creepy stories, come check us out on Patreon, where I will be reading at least 2 ghost stories a month as bonus episodes. I also offer a whole host of other goodies, including horror movie live stream, newsletters, and virtual tours of haunted places. Your support means more time for me to create more material for you. You can find us at patreon.com/itsalwayshalloween. It's Always Halloween is researched, written, and performed by me, Luce Tomlin Brenner. The editing, theme music, and sound design is by Pete Burns. Thanks, Pete. You can follow me on Instagram and Twitter at LTB Comedy and Pete at Mittenberries and the show at It's Always Halloween Podcast. If you're on Apple Podcasts, please subscribe and write us a little review so that like-minded ghouls can find us. Now you can also find us on the NPR One app. Just go to NPR and search for us, and you can download and stream us and get notifications about us right from that app. Thanks so much for listening to It's Always Halloween, and come back next time, unless you've lost your head.